everybody. It's me, Gina Murphy Darling. And this is going to be a really different kind of show. And I'm really, really, really excited about this. I just heard about our guest probably less than 24 hours ago. I don't have a long bio to read or a bunch of questions. But when my friend Josh Bellhumer from Brink told me about this and pulled up his artwork on his computer and then said he's in town for a couple of days, I just made the call that we were going to do an in-studio Impact Earth show if he was available. And he said yes. So we made the magic happen in a really short amount of time. And I'm not nervous. I'm excited, like beyond Thunderdome. So with me, sitting right here, is Benjamin Von Wong, also known as Ben. He's an artist through and through. His art is amazing, and we'll have the website on the show write-ups that you have to see. I think the website is vongwong.com, right? And his art is big. It's bold. I wouldn't call it art. I'd call it like big sculptures and displays and pieces. And you know what he says about himself? I'm always curious about what does somebody say about themselves? I'm an artist focused on amplifying positive impact. My mission is to help make positive impact unforgettable. And if you visit his website, that whole experience is guaranteed. So Ben, thanks for coming here. I know it wasn't easy. And I had a show about an hour ago, and I'm like, I don't care. I have to have you while you're here because you won't be here for long.
Thanks for making time for me. This is great.
Yeah, well, wait, so's your website. Oh my God. So people love stories. I'm trying to make every show about stories because they don't want facts, figures, statistics, Q&A. Your story is amazing because of what you did before and what you're doing now. So can you just tell us about your background and then how you got here to be sitting in this chair with me so gushing?
Yeah, so the quick 3-minute story. I grew up in 13 different schools in 3 different countries and 3 different languages. When I was going to university, I didn't know what to do with myself. My dad was an aeronautical engineer, and so I was like, okay, might as well go to engineering. I'm good at math and physics. Ended up as a hard rock mining engineer.
You've got to be kidding me.
Before graduating as a hard rock mining engineer, I was like, this is not what I want to do, but I had nothing better to do. And so I just went through with it and worked 3 years. But on the evenings and weekends, I had actually picked up a new hobby, photography. And so about 3.5 years into my career, I woke up one day and I was like, why am I going to work? This is not what I want to do. And although I didn't know what I wanted to do with myself, I knew it wasn't engineering. And so I thought I better start looking. So I basically put in my resignation letter a week later and started traveling the world. And the way I found that I could travel was through my art, by taking photos, by offering to teach different photo clubs of people how to take photos. I could travel for free. Someone would fly you in, you'd give a course, you'd have a place to crash, you'd make new friends, and then you could shoot something new, and then you'd fly to the next place. So I kind of did this nomad thing in 2012. As I got better, I built a following online. Eventually,
I'll say. We'll get into that.
I started getting better. I had a couple of viral hits. I think my biggest one was tying a model 30 meters underwater in a shipwreck in Bali, so 100 feet. That got picked up. And so I had a number of those successes that eventually led to some large global campaigns. And so in 2015, I did a cell phone commercial for Huawei, earned more money in that one job than my entire career combined, only to realize that, you know, I don't think that was something that I found that enjoyable.
What was the commercial?
It was just, we created these epic wings of fire, fire painting using a phone. It was just to market their phone. And okay. It was really cool. It was some really great images shot on a cell phone. It showcased the technology beautifully. But ultimately, what did it do? It just moved product off of a shelf. And instead of actually spending all my time creating the best thing possible, I was spending a lot of time in meetings. And so the effort versus the results versus the intention behind it just all didn't quite align. And so I started having a little bit of an existential crisis trying to figure out, well, what should I do with myself? And then I started thinking about, you know, the projects that I was most proud about throughout, you know, this journey. And it was always the campaigns that I had done for other people, whether it was, you know, a portrait series I did for a cancer patient or surprising a chronically ill fan in Australia on his 21st birthday, or this video that I had made for a little family whose kid was diagnosed with terminal degenerative brain disease. And it was like, those were the things that I just felt were the most compelling. And so I, at the end of 2015, beginning of 2016, I decided, you know what, I want to do impact. And I'm not sure how it's going to work because fantasy and impact are on two opposite ends of the spectrum, but I want to try. And so I just kind of embarked on that journey and turned down any job that didn't have an impact component, thinking it would be kind of easy. You know, I had done these big campaigns. I figured I could just take that same skill set and offer it to a nonprofit. Turns out nonprofits don't like risk. They don't like the unknown. And everything I do is kind of risky and kind of unknown. So it took about 18 months before I got my first job. But in the meantime, I did a ton of different experiments and fell into the environmental movement. I would credit my girlfriend, who I'm still with, for getting me into that, because she's always been a little bit more of a hippie than I was. And our first campaign together was going storm chasing to raise awareness for climate change. We used storms as a big metaphor for climate change. We spent 2 weeks chasing these storms across the Great Plains in an ambulance, a secondhand ambulance that would store all these props. And so we'd go chasing after these supercells, pull these props out, take photos of them, and have the big storms in the background. And so that was the first time that I saw that, oh, maybe there's a way to use metaphors as kind of a connective tissue between impact and art. And fantasy. So the second project I did for the environment was tying a model underwater with sharks swimming around. So I already knew how to tie models underwater. I figured, why not tie models underwater with sharks swimming around to raise awareness for shark conservation? And then the third one I did.
So I like want to stop you and say, okay, like who did you get to do that gig? Because that would not be one I'd sign up for.
She's
someone who has courage.
Yes, she's actually an electrician and a champion world freediver.
Got to be kidding me. Okay.
She flew herself to Fiji, which is where I was teaching a workshop, and volunteered.
Oh my God.
Because how often can you use your special skill of holding your breath for a very long time as a form of activism? And so that was just kind of a really great opportunity for all of us. Her name's Amber Bork. She's super talented. And so, you know, that campaign hit the front page of Reddit 3 times. We generated 88,000 petition signatures to create shark sanctuaries in Malaysia. And that's when things started like getting a little bit on a roll. And then the third campaign that I did was right around the time where the Great Pacific Garbage Patch was getting a little bit of attention.
Right.
And my mom found this mermaid tail designer, at home. My sister was just getting married. And so I was like, okay, well, while I'm in Montreal, maybe I can work with this mermaid tail designer. I have to have an impact component. How might I connect a mermaid and impact? And so from there, this idea of putting a mermaid on 10,000 plastic bottles came. And so a recycling company stepped in called Tomra. They provided us the 10,000 bottles and an 18-foot truck that just came in. And we got volunteers to clean them up over the course of a week. And then just laid a mermaid, like got a model, got hair, makeup, all that, and created this campaign.
Yeah, but it looks like she's in the ocean. I know that's your point. Yeah. I get it. Like, duh, Gina. But when I looked at that, you know, the thing about works of art like this for impact, when I looked at it, I went like this. I went, oh, seriously? And we're going to talk about the straw apocalypse too, but so go on. But I mean, really and truly, when you look at it, you go, wow, there's measuring impact right there with me saying that to you, like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, so I mean, the style that I've always gone for is this idea that, you know, you don't just want to get people to feel sad about something. You want them to feel curious, because curiosity is one of those things which open up the door for a conversation, right? I don't want to tell someone what's right and wrong. I just want to talk about what I did, how I did it, and why I did it without preaching to them, right? And I think that's when you can sort of draw a new crowd in. You know, I look at a lot of the activism work that happens around the environment, and so much of it is documentary based. I mean, the Nat Geos of the world, like the Paul Nicklins and all the BBC Earth stuff, like that is great. Like getting people to fall in love with the planet, that's one approach. And then you have all like the really tragic stuff, which I feel like is a little bit paralyzing because you don't know what to do about it. I decided to take kind of this tertiary approach, which is to show how like when people come together and they believe in something, great things can happen, regardless if you are well-funded or well-resourced or not. A lot of my projects are done with the help of volunteers. They always involve the community to come together. And maybe more important than the art itself is a process in how we got there. And so every story is not just about the art, but also about
the
journey.
It's not about the finished product. Mm-hmm. I get that. I hear that. That is what you're saying. And I looked at a lot of things on the website because I had, you know, I mean, seriously, everybody needs to know this. Yeah. I had breakfast with Josh. I had a bunch of other meetings. I had shows yesterday. There was a lot of family stuff going on. and I got an email from you, and I didn't get home till late, and I answered you at like 6:30, and before you know it, my phone's ringing, and I'm like, what? And it was a Las Vegas number, and yep. I usually don't answer numbers. I thought, you know what? Nobody calls me at 6:30 except my kids. And I answered it. And I said, oh my, and you said, I see you're up because I had answered the email. So this was supposed to happen. So yeah. So keep going. I'm loving this story.
Yeah, I know. So, I mean, that was basically it. I had done these three campaigns. And I think the third time is when, I guess, you know, people are always suspicious of outsiders, right? Like, just because I want to do impact work, is it genuine? Where does it come from? Right. So like by the third time, I think that's when I had built up just enough traction where people were like, oh, okay, maybe we can hire this guy. And so that's the first time that it became something replicable. So then I did a campaign for Dell around electronic waste. I've done a campaign for Nike where we elevated social influencers. I then did a project with Greenpeace to talk about how we need to turn off the tap, stop.
We'll talk about those recycling. A little bit. We don't have to hurry. So I saw what you did. I saw the visual for Dell because e-waste is so beyond atrocious. I know a lot about it. And I know that people throw their cell phones in the garbage. And I just want to say shame on you. They throw their computers. My husband is very willing to dumpster dive when we see somebody put a bunch of stuff in our waste thing that they do once a year for our homeowners association. So, but then tell me, what did you do for Nike? And what I didn't see that piece because I haven't had time to go down the rabbit hole of your website.
Yeah, no worries. Let's say with Nike, it wasn't an environmental project.
Okay.
They reached out to me and they had seen some of the crazy stuff I had done by dangling models off of
which
buildings.
Which is great.
And they were like,
and
oh, okay.
Sending them down for the sharks.
Yeah, and so they're like, oh, can you do something similar? We have this new shoe. It's called the Vapor Max, and it's made out of air. Like there's no cushioning. The cushioning is air, and we want to show how these entrepreneurs are defying conventions and want to put them in a high place. And so they asked me to come up with some concepts. And originally they wanted to use influencers, and I pushed back and I said, you know, why don't we elevate the people that you sponsor in your community? Let's elevate some voices of people who are making a difference. And so I think it's always been this sort of pushback. You know, at the end of the day, marketing is about selling product, but how do you take those dollars and leverage them and like funnel them into impact? With Dell, it was a little bit more direct. Because of my ocean plastic work, I was invited to speak on a panel that they were hosting. Because they have a bunch of ocean plastic initiative. They're trying to reintegrate it into a lot of their packaging, into some of their products. And ultimately, their goal is to become entirely closed loop. And I met I don't know what her exact title is, but let's call her like Director of Sustainability or something along those lines during one of those events. And she said like, you know, your plastic thing was pretty cool, but do you think you could do the same thing with electronic waste? And at the time, as with most things, I was just like, what's electronic waste? So every one of these projects for me is almost an excuse to learn about the problems, because you can't design a campaign unless you know about it. And I think the journey that I try to take people on is the same journey that I have as someone who, you know, ultimately I'm a city kid, right? I don't actually like to go hiking and be out in the middle of nature. I like the comforts of a modern city. And so I'm trying to speak to more people like me who maybe have never grown up and had the opportunity to be out in the wild and to see, well, what might draw them in. So I use a lot of metaphors in my work. I use a lot of visual symmetry. I try to use these shapes and forms and cultural pieces that are really familiar to people. With the Dell project, for example, you would see this like this spiral of 450 laptops that is actually inspired by the opening scene of Blade Runner, where you see these solar panels that they had designed in this sort of similar spiral, all focusing into a central point, which showed that old technology could be focused in and harnessed to create a new product. So I try to look for these similarities that people might not know where they saw it, but they'll know they've seen it before. And I think that's how I try to craft out that vein of familiarity between
and then
the
curiosity
work.
Can begin too, because I love about your journey, and it was similar for me. Like when I first started, what is e-waste? I didn't even know that the E stood for electronic waste. I kid you not. And now I say to people, how could you throw that cord in the garbage? You can take it out and use this for minerals and all this stuff. What about, how did you get, like, we have to talk about strawpocalypse because it is so big. And I mean physically, literally big.
Yeah.
And I want to know how you got that many straws, how many there were. Did you get people to help you collect them? Because that was a big project and it's gorgeous. I know you. That sounds ridiculous, but like that's another one where I went, you've got to be kidding me. And then I'm sure with photography, you know, you have this guy stretched, spread eagle, holding him up or something. I don't know.
He's just jumping.
Okay, and this little boy, did he really just jump?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You didn't like... No. You got to be kidding me. So now I hope that listeners are curious.
But there are videos. There are videos
gonna
that show
go look
how it's
at
done.
Struck. Yeah. It looked to me like you photoshopped him in.
I didn't know.
I love hearing that. And that little boy, was he real?
He's real. Everything's real.
Oh my God. I'm like, okay, they took this piece and they it sucks you in.
Yeah.
So tell us about Strawpocalypse.
Yeah. So Strawpocalypse is sort of the result of this this trend that I saw. So the trend was that as the proliferation of digital media slowly increases, right? We have more and more. Everyone's a photographer today. Everyone has an Instagram account. Everyone's an influencer. We all have influence. We all have the power to affect change, which is great. But that also means there's a lot more noise. So it becomes harder to stand out. And when it becomes harder to stand out and you have less guarantees of getting your content seen, regardless of how good it is, people are willing to pay less for it. And so this is a trend. And so as a photographer who creates digital content, you start being like, oh my gosh, this is a bad business model. So that realization that the work that I did, that no matter how great it became, was still an expensive production, would ultimately never scale. And so I would probably end up without a job regardless of how good I became. And so that realization led me through like a number of different strategic paths where I was like, okay, well, how might I pivot away from what I do into something while still retaining the ability to create these amazing worlds? And so where that thought process landed me was like, okay, well, what are the industries that are growing? And the experiential market is growing because everyone's a photographer and everyone's feeling increasingly disconnected. They're looking for new opportunities to connect. So they're going to different spaces to connect with people. They all want to show off what they're experiencing. So they're driven by a desire for selfies. What if I could take these these big, large campaigns that I'm doing and open it up to the public? What if I could open source my photography by creating the world for everyone to take part in? And so Strawpocalypse was sort of one of the first attempts at doing that. And so for those who haven't seen it or if those want to imagine it, we basically spent 9 months collecting straws, 168,000 straws across Vietnam, all over the country, organized by a nonprofit called Zero Waste Saigon. They collected all these straws, gathered them into one single place. I arrived in January and I had 3 weeks in order to figure out how to take all of these straws and convert them into something that would be really interesting and powerful. So we had like a 3D model that was designed by a couple volunteers, one located in San Francisco called Nick Moser, and the other in Vietnam called Fosha. And so she was a translator literally between the two CAD models, the two technologies, and English and Vietnamese, right? And so from there, found the fabricators to build the engineering component of it. But then we just laid ourselves out inside of a mall and had all these volunteers coming by
like
every single day.
Mall?
A shopping mall. And it was just people, like kids, 3-year-old kids that would come by and help us build the different components of this entire thing. And so over the course of 2 weeks, volunteers came, cleaned everything, we mounted them, and we created this installation. So it's a Guinness World Record. And it was funded thanks to Starbucks, which is kind of interesting.
I loved seeing that too. And I am telling you, I know so much about what Starbucks has done and continues to do in the sustainability space. Yeah. They realize that they're part of the problem.
They do.
And they're trying to be part of the solution.
They're trying to be part of the solution. And I think what's really interesting is that it's really easy to point the finger at corporations and go like, oh, they're not doing anything or they're, you know, they need to stop right away. But like the world doesn't actually work that way, right?
Ever. Not
never
ever.
Does. Change takes time. And we can argue about how how slow it is. We can all agree that it's maybe too slow. However, I do think effort matters, and being a pioneer in these fields and leading the way is really difficult. And so even by funding an installation like mine opens them up to criticism. It's actually like quite a risky move. And so I respect the idea that they would want to support initiatives like this because they believe in the core mission, even at the expense of the risk that it could bring. And, you know, I think there are two different ways to approach activism. You can think of it as like, oh, I'm going to tear the system down. I'm just going to point my finger at everything I see wrong.
Which shuts people down so big time. They don't want to hear it at all. They don't want to hear it. They don't, please don't do that. don't do that. I don't want to be preached to. I don't want to be brought down. So that's not the kind of impact that I think most people are looking for. And your art, I don't even know what to call what you do, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's for me, I think you can, it's like when you have a kid that's misbehaving, you can either beat them every time they do something wrong or encourage them when they do something right. And so a lot of what I do is try to encourage moments in time where the good is happening and to encourage more of it. I don't know if it always, it's really hard to know if it's entirely the right thing. I recently read a book called Winners Take All. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, by Anand Giridharadas. And his contention is that the world doesn't need more good. It needs less harm. And we need the bigger companies to do less bad instead of having all these good initiatives that they're trying to promote. Because ultimately, if they're only trying to do more good, the good is generally very marginal compared to the entire systemic structure, the way the business is built, right? So,
and one of the things that freaks me out, and I mean, I can become, I'm a closet fanatic because I have to be this persona. I feel it's really important. I don't want to judge. I don't want to preach. I don't want to lecture. Mm-hmm. And yet inside of me, there's this burning urgency, like we've got to hurry up because the clock's ticking, and knowing that doesn't work. But when it comes to the whole, when you say, you know, change happens over time, to me, we have to kind of speed up the conversation and put it on fast forward, especially in the area of plastics, because of how it's impacting our health. Not just the oceans and the fish and the birds, they're finding it in breast cancer samples. I mean, we don't even know all the bad stuff that plastic's mm-hmm. happening. And I say to people, my closest friends, and they'll know when they listen to this, I am so glad you should see my recycling bin. And I say to them, well, does it have almost nothing in it? Because that's the real game. That's the end game. R. The first R is reduce. And then a friend corrected me the other day. She said, no, it's refuse. Mm-hmm. So there is the whole reduction. But when you're doing it, like when you did this massive straw apocalypse, it was in Vietnam, right? Mm-hmm. Did you keep it in the mall? Like, where is it?
It stayed there for 2 months and then had nowhere to go.
So oh, you've got to be kidding
me. It ended
me.
Up getting... So every time I do an installation, so far they get disposed of to the best of the ability of the place in which they're created.
Right.
And so in Vietnam, we got them recycled into concrete.
That's really good, though.
Which is...
I mean, that's really good.
Which is better than it going to landfill, yes. Which is where most of it would have
yep.
gone there.
Because, totally.
I mean,
totally.
Because... But that's part of the conversation, right? Like, so I create these installations and everyone's like, oh, but where did it go after? And I'm like, that's the point. There's nowhere for it to go. That is exactly what the conversation we're trying to spark is.
Yeah. Yes, there
but suddenly
is
it matters to people. And I'm like, no, this is happening every second. This is not something different. It just happens
it's not
to
a point
feel
in time.
Different.
Exactly. Right, right, right.
It feels different because I've now given these things that were going to be discarded in 10 minutes like a little more utility for that small period in time.
And what about, like I was saying, when Chris Jordan impacted my journey?
Mm-hmm.
His photography, and it was all done digital photography except his work on Midway, which was, you know, you watch that and cry. I do, even still, because, you know, the whole story about that. But he did it through visual. And when you talk about impact, I just want to go back to that a little bit. Your website impacted me. So, count that, right? What is your thought about how to even measure impact? You've had like 100 million views on your work.
Mm-hmm.
You have to put that as a metric of impact, because if people aren't interested, you're not going to get 100 million views. I don't care, whatever. So what are your thoughts? You know, this is kind of the existential conversation about what is impact. I ask myself all the time, what kind of impact are we having? Is it listens? Is it people changing their behavior, which I can't measure? So where do you put that in your head? Because you are all about that.
Yeah, we're asking the same questions. And I appreciate that you're telling me that it's impacted you because now I can know, I can file that away. But that's really hard to sell.
It is.
And so I approach everything that I do from a marketing perspective because ultimately I'm a marketer. I'm an artist. But what's made me who I am is my ability to get things seen and heard by people. And what I've noticed over time is that all of the statistics that we have to measure impact right now only measure breadth of impact. They don't measure depth of impact, right? You only can, you can see how many likes something got. You can see how
that's
many clicks it got. You can see how many views it got. But it doesn't actually talk about how that has affected someone over the course of their lifetime. And so actually this is the question that I've, that has sort of driven me to travel here to Tucson in the first place. So I've been in San Francisco for 4 years. I was looking to explore the intersection of art, impact, and technology. And the general idea as I got deeper and deeper into the impact movement was that if it was possible to better measure the impact of art, then you could sell the impact of art. And if you can sell the impact of art, then more people would create impactful art because there would be a market for it. But because you don't have those metrics, what you end up having is that all these talented artists get sucked up into the world of entertainment and marketing, or they go down the fine art route where the art is meant for the 0.1%. And so that at the end of the day, you have all of the most talented people in the world that aren't able to apply what they do best to support a world that needs it really, really badly. And so over the last week, and I'm at the beginning of my journey right now, so I don't have the answers, but over the last week, I've been exploring the duality of impact. So I think there's two ways that art impacts people. One is through process. The process of art, a process of creating art, allows people of diverse viewpoints to come together under a shared common interest. You can rally different ideologies. You can bring different people. You can have them express themselves. You can help them find meaning or purpose. Like, there's this entire component to art that is process driven. And I think that's probably where a lot of like funding for the arts kind of comes into play. And then there's outcome art, which is kind of what I do, which is more on the activism front. And that one, I still haven't managed to find that many people who are playing in that space. However, what I'm coming to understand is that maybe in order to better measure art, you need to change the conditions under which you plan your campaigns. And so what I mean by that is, if you planned your campaign in such a way that it was an environment that was inherently measurable in the first place, you would be able to measure that a lot easier. Instead of trying to say, I'm going to try to change the world, right? It's too wide. What if you tried to change a community? What if you tried to change a school? What if you tried to change a person, right?
A like neighborhood,
what if,
yeah.
What if it was not about the output of the art or the process of the art, but rather the outcome of the art? And what if you designed your art in that way? And I think maybe a huge part that's missing is that design thinking process. Because if you don't think of it from an outcome perspective, you hand over the responsibility of impact to someone else. So like, I create something, I hope that it touches someone's heart, and hopefully they do the right thing now, right? Like, I'm handing over the responsibility.
Right.
But what if, in order for the art to be complete, the outcome had to be measurable in there? And so those are the questions I'm asking. I don't know if I'm giving you the answers.
Kidding me. Raising the question. And it makes me go, you know, down the rabbit hole or off on the magic carpet ride. And the other thing, when you were talking, the art that you do, just people seeing it is impactful because it does beg questions. Why did he do this? Or how did you get those straws? Or is this about plastic? So it just, you know, my tagline for the show for a long time was, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And my belief is, if people just started really thinking more consciously about the impact of their actions and their consumerism and what they eat, they would self-direct. It wouldn't be about campaigns or ads or whatever, but some people have never thought about the impact of 168,000 straws. Mm-hmm. They just think they used one. It doesn't even show up on their radar. They just get it in their water glass, which is like, what? The one you have right here for you has a reusable straw. We don't have any stinking straws in this house. But to me, there's so much around art. And the other thing that I think about art for the most part is it's for the most part non-threatening because it's a choice to observe it. I don't know if that makes sense. Talk about existential is that I don't have to go to an art gallery. I don't have to go down the rabbit hole. It's not in your face. It's when it can pique curiosity and evoke interest, that's impact right there. And I mean, I don't think we're ever going to be able to measure that. But what I learned from here is that it doesn't matter where that unbelievable art display went. It doesn't. It matters that you had an impact, and then it does matter how it got disposed of. I mean, I'm not saying that, but it was a conscious, intentional way to get rid of it. But it is in the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, like the last time I went to New York and I went to the Guggenheim, first of all, I could live in the Guggenheim. It's just such a massive work of art itself. But there were a lot of the displays were about, it was environmental impact. So the next question is, I feel like we're in a big shift. I know I'm joined by hundreds of millions of people that think that. I mean, big shift, the massive shift of everything, of more balance. Hopefully it's going to be painful getting there. From when you started to now, I live in a world of environmental consciousness. I surround myself with people that are, I don't have a lot of social time with people who aren't, because that's what I have to do to show up every day for what I'm doing. I want to invite people in that don't share my goals. Mm. So that's why I try not to be, confrontive or judgmental or any of those things. But with art, do you feel like it's changing? Because I do. I feel like more people want to see what you're doing, and more people want to be guided as to where to start, because they know that we are in deep and serious trouble as a planet. And I feel like a shift that I have to believe is coming.
So I can answer you in two ways. I can answer you on metrics, and then I can answer you on feeling. So on the metrics front, what's been really interesting as I made this commitment to do impact work, the images I shot 3 years ago are just as popular now, if not more popular now, than they were when I first released them.
Okay.
And I think it's because they address an issue that hasn't been resolved yet. And so in that sense, the work will become timeless. They're symbolically timeless. They're new to anyone who's never seen them before. They carry the same emotional resonance. And the number of magazines and books and Instagram accounts and other people who might be seeking to use it, borrow it, feature it, has gone up.
Got it. Okay.
So is there an increased consciousness? I think yes. Are people more hopeful or more frustrated? That's, I think, maybe an interesting question, because I would say that hope is a double-edged sword. If you hope, campaign, do everything that you possibly can, fight as hard as you possibly can, and nothing changes, picking someone back up from that point is really, really difficult. And so I wonder if in this generation of outrage, of entitled is maybe the wrong word, but just this sense that like things have to happen fast and immediately, and maybe for good reason. But when expectations don't meet reality, there's a sense of defeat that will always come. And so I would say that the other trend that I have observed with the people that have been following me for this amount of time is a shift from, wow, that's amazing, it's changing my behavior, to, I already know it's a problem and nothing is changing and I'm doing all the right things, but I can do all the right things, but if the system isn't changing, we're screwed. And so I think there's a shift, and I think art needs to shift with it. And that's actually part of what's driving a lot of these new questions, is that awareness is not enough, because all these awareness campaigns, for the most part, put the blame on the consumer to be more responsible. But the consumer actually doesn't have any choice anymore. You go to the supermarket, you can't really avoid plastic unless you're extremely privileged, unless you have the time to go around and be zero waste, unless you have the privilege or the money to vote with your dollars. Like, most people can't do that. And so at the end of the day, like, we need hope that comes from measurable change. I think we need more stories of transformation and less stories of awareness. People know the problem. People know climate change is coming. Now, what can they do about it? More than just themselves. How can David beat Goliath? And how can we create more blueprints and frameworks and case studies for that? And so with the projects that I'm trying to do these days, it's a lot less about how many people can I reach, but what system can I change? And it doesn't have to be big. Because if you think of the most viral, positive green news out there, it would be the one little supermarket in Bali that now serves all their stuff in banana leaves. Or it would be the one little town in Japan that recycles their stuff in like 17 different bins or whatever. It's the small case studies of hope that we need to latch onto, and we need more of those, and we need those to not just be a one-time thing. We need those to be a blueprint that can be reapplied over and over again, because that's where I think actual measurable change will start to happen. We have to think more in terms of movements and less in terms of like independence.
I love what you said. Like, I'm out of my skin. Love it. About awareness is not enough. And so things are shifting for me. It's not. People ask me all the time, what should I do? What should I do? And depending upon what week it is, now I'm on the kick of, but there's a but here of, this will crack you up. You don't see this coming. Plant milkweed. That's what I say to people. If you have any yard space, plant milkweed. And they're like, that's what you're telling me to do? And I said, yeah, you plant milkweed. And then you come back to me and tell me what happens. Because the monarch butterfly are endangered. It's scary how fast their numbers are being impacted. So that's awareness, right? What the heck am I going to do about monarch butterflies? So I had this guy on the show from National Wildlife Federation. And he's a great storyteller. He has a TV show and all this. And he starts talking about milkweed. I'm like, milkweed? What the heck are you talking about? So I went and got one milkweed plant, which I'll show you after the show if you want to see it. Sure. It was at the end of the season. And this guy said to me at the local nursery, he goes, what do you want milkweed for? Now, it's November and this is not a good time because I have one that I'm just putting in the compost pile. Do you want it? And I went, yes. And I have to tell you, because this is the story. So I got the milkweed plant. James put it in a planter. We watered it. And it starts growing leaves, like right away. First of all, we're in the desert Southwest. It's not freezing much. I don't think we had a freeze yet. And it starts growing. He said, keep it outside. If it goes under 40, bring it in the house. We brought it in the house. The whole family gets here for the holidays. And I'm so proud of this milkweed plant because it had nothing on it. It had like three little leaves. And it's grown like crazy. So I get up one morning before anybody else. The house is full. Bunch of dogs, kids, everything. And I'm sitting down on the couch in the quiet. And I go, oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. The milkweed is naked. Like, it is stripped. And I was like, oh my God, the dogs wouldn't eat it. The baby doesn't even crawl yet. So I go up to it because we brought it in because it was cold. There are four caterpillars. Okay? So now think about how I am sucked in. I'm going to do a video series on what happened because there was no food left for them. And we didn't have another milkweed plant. And it was the winter. And we called every nursery in this town. Nobody had milkweed. It's a seasonal thing. And then we had to go away. My husband and I and everybody left to go to Taos, but my daughter's here. And we're telling her, don't kill the caterpillars. You can't let them die. So she researches it, finds out the only other thing that caterpillars will eat is butternut squash. Like, can I make this up? I could not make this up. So she's FaceTiming us. She cuts these things out and she puts the butternut squash in little thin, you know, pieces on it. The caterpillars find it. They start eating it. By the time we got back, we had four, I call them the chrysalis, on this milkweed plant. No leaves. And we have gotten to see two of them come out and become gorgeous monarch butterflies. And the point of that story is, if you can get someone connected through one single act,
yeah.
A lot of my friends are now planting milkweed. It sounds like white privilege to me because I can afford milkweed. I can go to the nursery in my car, get it. But there are things you can get, a seed packet and put it on your apartment, you know, get dirt and put it on your apartment balcony if you have one. But that's, to me, a lot of what you're saying. I'm aware, but I never did anything about butterflies for 10 years. Like, I'm really sad. What can I do? Well, now, milkweed is helping to bring back the butterflies. So it's like those stories times a million, what you're trying to do.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And I try to create stories of communities coming together because people love the David versus Goliath stuff. Like, they need to know that if people stand up, change can happen. So like if you made this a community initiative and you got like an entire neighborhood of, and it doesn't have to be huge, it can just be like 50 households all to plant
one. That's a great idea.
See what happens. And then, but that story becomes local news. That local story becomes national news. That national news becomes a story of hope. And then And people need to see a little bit more, I think, than just personal involvement, because they've heard that story so many times. You know, back in the 80s, it was like, don't throw your trash on the street. Then it became like, oh, recycle. And then now it's like, oh, you got to refuse. And it's like, okay, but like, we're just following along with these instructions, but the whole system is broken. So like, not really making a difference. So they need to see, like, you want to see how like a small little group of people rising up have a big impact. Like the Bye Bye Plastic Bag girls in Bali, right? Like two little middle school girls, finally, I mean, it took them 5 years, but they finally got it banned in Bali. And that's just one story. So if you have more of these stories, and if we as people who have the privilege of thinking about designing these stories can empower those who are right at the beginning of their journey, and just guide them so that they can reap the glory, I think that's where things become really, really exciting. So,
yeah, well, thanks for putting that challenging guilt trip on me.
No. Like, it wasn't meant to be a guilt trip.
I know that. You are so not about a guilt trip. Like, there's no part of you that does that. But like, I took it, I'm like, oh my God, that is such a great idea.
Yeah.
And if whole neighborhood did it, that really makes an impact for the butterflies.
It's been one of like my big challenges. So as an artist, when you struggle to stand out as an artist, you try to be as unique and different as possible. And you are the hero of that journey, right? But then as you try to move into impact, as you try to create change, it can't be about how unique you are. It has to become more about how you start a movement and how similar we are.
What an evolution.
And so it becomes like the opposite tension.
Right.
So now I have all this experience and I'm like, okay, how can I now use the access and privilege I have managed to obtain to elevate others and use my influence to become like the guy who kind of stepped in, who didn't do it, but just helped guide people in the right direction? And so I'm trying to look for those kinds of stories because those are the ones that people want to hear. Nobody cares that like this artist who's already well known has done another thing. It's repetitive. It's redundant. We want to hear more stories of how people who had nothing completely transformed something.
Like those two little girls in Bali. I totally agree with you. And I see stuff. I'm a big fan of CBS Sunday Morning because they showcase what one kid started doing and you know, getting his mom to help and animal rescue. And I mean, the stories go on. So I am aware of people's attention span and I could go on. I mean, you could be sleeping and I'd be still thinking of more questions, but thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank Josh Bellhumer who said, you got to meet this guy. Like seriously, Gina, you got to meet this guy. And what I'm happy about is I did it. Oh, my so-called busy life schedule. And I thought, no, when I looked at your work, I want to meet. I didn't want it to be a missed opportunity and then maybe our paths would never cross. And we have lots of listeners. But my takeaway is really important for me and the work I'm doing because we changed the names of our shows to Impact Earth and Impact Humanity. I think it's pretty funny that that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And that's what the game has to be going forward. What can I do to save those wolves in Yellowstone? I'm figuring that out. Yeah. What kind of impact can I have so that they're around when my granddaughter has kids? So it's great. And I want to know one last question. Do you know what's next or are you still in the exploration phase? It sounds like there's a big transition for you that we should be excited about.
Well, I'm nomadic for a year right now and Tucson was my first stop. I have a form online. It's vonwang.info. And that's how I'm actually crashing at different people's places all over the world, which is really, really amazing. And then just by pulling on that thread and telling people what questions I'm asking of people who are exploring the intersection of art, impact, technology, and impact can also mean community and just how change is happening. I've just been following that thread of meeting people like you who've been in the fight for long periods of time and exploring all these topics. And actually, the first person I ended up meeting here in Tucson brought me on a podcast. This is the second podcast I'm doing in a week.
You're kidding. Who did it?
His name's Justin. He's a photographer and he's just launching his own. And I'm like, oh, how cool. And as I've had all these conversations, I just feel the need to also hold on to them too. And so I might actually be on the verge of starting my own. So I'm going to have to ask you for some help and advice on how to do this.
How happy would I be? Talk about impact. It's just like, it lights me up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I knew I could do it and I didn't have a lot of prep time and it didn't matter because I knew from looking at your work that we would have a lot to talk about. So thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
And I'll be watching.
Yeah.
I'll be watching. We'll put the your website online. And who knows, because we had almost 1 million listeners last year.
Amazing.
And so maybe you'll be hearing from somebody in Michigan or Detroit, or we have some in Buenos Aires. So yeah.
I'll be sure to let you know so that you can track your impact.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to put that out there to the universe so I know that we made an impact. But thank
Absolutely.
You so much for being here, Ben. And I'm going to be watching because it really matters. Thanks.
Thank you.